Hello and welcome. My guest today didn't have it easy. Growing up in the deep American South in Alabama, product of a violent African-American father, a Korean mother, Paul K. Chappelle experienced the ugliness of racism that a child should never experience. A thinker, not a fighter, Paul channeled his challenges to try to figure out what made people tick. He eventually applied what he had uncovered to perhaps the most noble, and some would say quixotic, of virtues, the pursuit of world peace. Joining me on the line is Paul K. Chappelle, author of the book The End of War, How Waging Peace Can Save Humanity, Our Planet, and Our Future. Paul, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show, Dave. I really appreciate it.
Paul, was my introduction fairly accurate?
Yeah, it was, except that in terms of not being a fighter, I used to be kind of an aggressive kid. Growing up as a kid, I got in a lot of fights and things like that, so I think that I became more of a thinker, but I think that all young children are, in a way, thinkers. They are naturally curious. They have questions about everything, and I think I just maintained that throughout my adulthood.
Right. Thank goodness for that. World peace. It's all about an idea, isn't it, Paul?
Right, it is.
Tell our listeners why it really is all about an idea.
Every human achievement starts off as an idea. Every revolution in human history starts off initially as an idea. And every achievement, every ounce of progress begins with an idea. And I think that if human beings cannot formulate an idea of what's possible, they can't begin to take the appropriate steps to achieve that goal. And I think that the idea is vital in terms of not just having a vision of what's possible, but having a plan to work in that direction.
There's precedent for ideas working to change the course of civilization. Isn't that so?
Right, right.
In the past, how has history shown that ideas can be a powerful motivator?
Well, for example, 200 years ago in America, anyone who wasn't a white male landowner was oppressed. If you were African American, Asian, Hispanic, even if you were white but you didn't own land, you were oppressed. And 150 years ago in America, women couldn't vote their own property. And you hear the founding fathers talk about no taxation without representation. And what that basically means, of course, is that you can't tax me unless you give me a vote. You can't control me or have authority over me unless you give me a say. But up until the 1820s and 1830s, 50 years after the Revolutionary War, less than 10% of the American population could vote. Women couldn't vote. African Americans couldn't vote. And white people couldn't vote unless they owned land. But the women didn't fight a war to get the right to vote and the right to own property. The African Americans didn't get their human rights really until the Civil Rights Movement. That's when they truly got their human rights. And the non-landowners didn't fight a war to get the right to vote. And 500 years ago in America, things such as democracy, the right to vote, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, women's and civil rights virtually didn't exist anywhere on the planet. I mean, 500 years ago, there weren't any democracies in the world. 200 years ago, Napoleon was dictator in France, and America wasn't a democracy if you were African-American or female or Hispanic or white unless you owned land. But all that change happened. Now, if let's say that I gave a talk at a high school or college tomorrow and I said we need to bring back slavery and bring back segregation and women shouldn't vote their own property, I mean, how would people react to that? They'd think I'm crazy.
Right.
But 200 years ago, that was a common viewpoint. And all that happened, all that changed by changing how people think. If you go on TV and use the N-word, people don't look upon that very favorably. And all this has just happened because of ideas that change how people think and change how people see their humanity and the humanity of other people. So we have to keep going. If we come so far, why can't we keep going in that direction?
I agree. On page 82, and this was actually one of the parts of the book that I highlighted. In fact, I have about 50 notes, not questions, just notes. On page 82, you say that when my father was drafted into the Army as an African American in 1949, the military was segregated. The government upheld an official policy that viewed African Americans as inferior and subhuman. 50 years before that, the government would not allow women to vote, and only 50 years prior to that, the government supported and protected slavery. So if you think about it, what you're saying, 50 years really isn't that much, right?
Right. It's dramatic change. Dramatic change in a short amount of time.
Right. So it's probably not a long time before we actually can achieve world peace, right?
People ask me, well, how long will it take to achieve world peace? And I say, well, that depends. And I can answer that question with another question. How long does it take to run a mile? You can run a mile in 4 minutes. I think the world record is under 4 minutes. You can run a mile in 5 minutes. You can run a mile in 10 minutes. You can walk a mile in half an hour. You can walk a mile in an hour. You can begin running a mile and quit halfway through. You can never take the first step. How long it takes to run a mile depends upon what you do. And we could have world peace in 5 years. We could have it in 20 years. We could have it in 100 years. You might never have it. It depends upon what we do, and not just the quantity of our actions, but also the quality of our actions. The important thing, though, is that it is possible. That's what the books really talk about.
Right. So most people would probably poo-poo the whole idea. I imagine you come across a lot of people who say, that's impossible.
Yeah, and I think that there's a couple reasons for that. I think that they haven't seen the evidence. They aren't aware of the evidence that shows why it is possible, because most people don't know anything about war. They don't know anything about violence. They don't know anything about military history. And when I talk about world peace, I'm talking about ending politically organized violence between countries. There might be a future where there's still murder, but it would be a better future if there was less murder, and there'd be a much better future if there weren't millions of people dying in war. But ending the politically organized violence between countries, and one thing that the world is seeing now is war is horrible for the country waging war. I mean, our country's going to go bankrupt with these two wars. And the lesson the world is learning now is, wow, don't be like the U.S. If you want to survive as a hegemon, if you want to survive as a superpower, don't start invading other countries, because it'll turn the world against you, and you will waste so many resources there it'll bankrupt your economy. We're living in an interconnected world now where even if you are the country waging war, you can't really get what you want out of warfare anymore. And we didn't succeed in Vietnam. The Soviets didn't succeed in Afghanistan. And right now we're seeing a situation where war is very counterproductive as a means of achieving any kind of national aim.
There would be so many reasons to shoot down your argument, your quest. You know, there's so many things you could say, oh, God, that'll never work, because, like you said, on page 5 and on page 11, there's violence, greed, ignorance, and materialism. So how are you going to overcome these things and have everybody just do it?
One question I often ask people is, I ask them, why was Europe able to conquer the entire world? You know, why was Europe able to go to every continent and conquer every continent? And the primary reason was because for 500 years, Europe was the bloodiest place on earth. Europe had 500 years of constant, continual warfare. And when you do something for 500 years, you get really good at it. So when the Europeans went to other countries, they had waged war for so long that they had transformed war into a science. So when they went to other continents can compete with the Europeans militarily. So Europe, for 500 years, was the bloodiest place on earth. A lot of that was religious conflict. But could you imagine a war now in Western Europe? Could you even imagine France going to war with Germany, or Germany going to war with Great Britain?
No.
Almost hard to fathom. And that's the bloodiest place in human history is now in some sort of peace. And another example, too, is the United States has 50 states. We have diverse demographics. Alabama is very different from California. And we have 50 states. And it doesn't really cross the minds of the government in Alabama to invade the government of Georgia. It doesn't really cross the minds of the government in California to invade the government of Arizona. And why can't we create a system internationally where, just as we have peace in the most violent place in human history, Europe, and we have some sort of peace between states, the United States, why can't we have it internationally? And what major powers are realizing now is, even if you do have a strong military and you invade a country, you can't always impose your will and get what you want. I think a couple of examples are nonviolence, where Gandhi was able to throw off the British Empire. And other examples are even with violence. For example, the Vietnamese defeating the U.S., the Afghans defeating the Soviets, and the U.S. not being able to conquer Afghanistan right now. So even from the perspective of a major power, it goes into your decision-making process. Even if I want to invade this country, I can't get what I want. And I think that we are in an interconnected world. That's the reality of the world today. And 200 years ago in America, people saw themselves as a Georgian first, a Virginian first, and they're an American second. So I'm a Georgian, I'm a Virginian, and I'm an American second. But if you said that today, people would say you're unpatriotic. You know, we're Americans first. And it's just another small leap in perception to go from I'm an American to I'm a member of the global human family. Just another small leap in perception to go from I'm an American to I'm a member of the human race. And that's the reality of our world today, is that we're irreversibly interconnected, and the fate of every country is tied to the fate of every other country and the fate of the planet. And we have to learn how to live together as human beings, or we're not going to survive as a human race. So,
very well said. Now, Paul, you have actually a cure for war. You have what seems like a solution to overcoming the need to go to war. Now, setting aside all of the other reasons, the profit motive and so on and so forth, what is that cure?
Yeah, this is what I primarily write about in the books. And the cure is both simple and complex, but it begins with understanding why wars happen. And I talk about how if you look at segregation, if you look at the oppression of women, if you look at state-sanctioned slavery, if you look at any system of injustice, if you look at apartheid in South Africa, all of those things are caused by something very simple, how people think. Human ways of thinking cause apartheid, segregation, oppression, slavery, those kinds of things. And those entire systems are generated by how people think, and specifically myths, things that people think that actually aren't true. So, for example, with the oppression of women, a lot of people thought, well, women just aren't smart enough to vote. They're not intellectually equal to men, and it's just not in their capacity to vote. And with segregation, people thought, well, African Americans aren't human beings. They're subhuman. We can't have African Americans and white people living together. That's like having farm animals and people living together. They're just a different species. But those things proved to be untrue. And state-sanctioned slavery, people thought, well, it's in the nature of some people to be slaves. These people are born to be slaves. I can't let my slaves go. That's like letting my sheep go or letting my dogs go. They don't know how to live without proper guidance and proper ownership because they're not capable of being free. And once those things prove to be untrue, and they are untrue, just like people thought that the world is flat, people thought that the sun goes around the earth, people used to believe all sorts of things that weren't true based off limited knowledge. The whole system starts to come apart. And there's three primary myths that keep the war system running today. The first myth is that human beings are naturally violent, and if people want to see the evidence for that, the evidence is all the military history, that we're not naturally violent. The second myth is that war is inevitable, and the third myth is that war makes us safe. So one reason that so many people put up with war, especially Americans put up with war, is they think, well, it makes us safe. And if I tell you war protects your freedom and your family and your way of life and your religion, you'll put up with it. You'll see it as a necessary evil. But once you start to unravel those myths, the entire system can begin to come apart. If people knew the truth that war makes us less safe, not only in terms of security, but it's bankrupting our economy, it changes the whole situation in terms of how people see the problem.
Right. And then you say we can have not just a win-win situation, but a win-win-win-win situation. How is that possible?
Well, a win-win-win-win situation would be where, for example, I benefit, you benefit, the whole country benefits, and the whole planet benefits. So, for example, if I become a more loving, appreciative, compassionate human being, I benefit because my life is more meaningful. You benefit because I'm a nicer person to be around. The whole country benefits if I'm a nicer, more compassionate, loving human being because we need more people like that in our country, and the whole world benefits from people like that. So there are situations where there are certain human behaviors where everybody does benefit in terms of our world and our country and our communities. Our families need more people who are like that to sustain not just the local but the global level of human progress.
Right. I think from reading your fine book that probably a very important factor that's going to determine whether or not we eventually do get to world peace is what you call misplaced fear. That's something that I think is probably the biggest culprit in all this, because I'm guilty of it too. You see a stranger, maybe you don't like the way they look, but then something happens where they end up talking and like, wow, this is a nice person. It seems like humans naturally are very distrusting of other humans very quickly until one little thing makes them realize, hey, this person's not that bad. Why is that?
Well, I think that if you look at, I think a good account is, if you look at all the accounts of the European explorers coming to the Americas, the Pilgrims, Columbus, all the European explorers coming to Americas, look at how the Indians treated them. They greeted them with hospitality. They gave them food. I mean, that's why we have Thanksgiving coming up. That came from the Pilgrims coming to America, and the Native Americans shared food with them. And if you look at Columbus coming to the Americas, the Native Americans there, they wanted to trade. They wanted to learn. What are these strange-looking people, and why are they on our shore? And if you look at all the accounts of the European explorers, there aren't accounts of the Native Americans immediately going towards the Europeans. The Europeans brought violence with them. This doesn't mean there wasn't conflict between Native American tribes, but I guess a way I can probably explain it in more simple terms is, let's say an alien spaceship landed on our planet tomorrow. I would be very curious. Let's say a creature walked out of the spaceship, he didn't immediately start shooting at us, and he was talking or trying to talk in some sort of language. I think a lot of people would be very curious. What is this strange-looking creature? And he looks kind of like me. He's from a different land. And that's how the Native Americans must have seen the Europeans. The Europeans showed up. They had light skin. They had sometimes blue eyes. They had metal. They were wearing armor. They had horses. That must have been a very strange appearance. But if you look at those kinds of interactions, it gives you a lot of hope about human nature, because we didn't have situations where the Columbus or the Pilgrims came to the Americas and they were thrown off the shore by these violent tribal people. They actually tried to live in harmony with them, and things went horribly wrong. But I think it says a lot of positive things about human nature that we're not as distrusting as people think. We live in a very distrustful society. Ever since I was a kid, don't talk to strangers. Strangers are dangerous, and lock your doors. And we do live in a society that does make people violent. So those are very important precautions. But how much of that is human nature and how much of that is conditioning from our society?
That's a good question. Yeah, I did enjoy those several examples in the book about the Native Americans, the way that they greeted the Europeans. That was inspiring. Let's give the audience a little of your history before we go any further. You were in the Army for, I guess, you got out about a year ago, right?
I got out of the Army last November.
What was the date?
Veterans Day.
There you go. So this, yeah. Right. So this is actually the 1 year anniversary of you getting out, because if we went to tomorrow, it would be 1 year and 1 day. So coincidentally, you've been out 1 year. Why did you go into the Army? You were in for 8 years or something like that?
7 years.
7 years. Why did you go into the Army and why did you not re-enlist?
I think there's several reasons why I went in. I think that nobody goes in for one sole reason. I think it's always multiple reasons. And I think one reason was I was always taught by my society that you need war to end war, you need violence to stop violence, and I thought, well, if you join the Army, join the Army. If you want to make the world safe, if you want to make America safe, if you want to promote freedom around the world, join the Army. That was what I was always taught. If you look at Spider-Man, Superman, or Batman, to protect humanity and save the world, they beat up the bad guy and they use violence. Action movies, the hero kills the bad guy, saves the world. And I think that had a lot to do with it, just that idealism. The Army does attract a lot of idealistic people. I've never seen a military recruiting commercial that says you have to kill people. It's all about be all you can be, aim high, accelerate your life, serve your country, make a difference in the world. Another reason, too, is economic. Neither of my parents went to college, and they couldn't afford to send me to a good school. And West Point is a really fantastic education. And I think another primary reason, too, is ever since I was a small child, my parents always told me, they always said, the only place in America where a black man has a chance is in the Army. And my father was born in 1925. He grew up during the Great Depression in the South in Virginia under segregation. And the Army had desegregated about a decade prior to big civil rights achievements. And that was his reality. He felt that the only place he had a chance was in the Army, where there was some sort of opportunity for him. And I told my mother I was getting out of the Army last year, and she goes, are you crazy? What are you thinking? As soon as people find out you're part black, they won't hire you. It's bad enough you look Asian, but you're also part black. And it's not that my parents don't know what they're talking about, but they were living in a different era and a different culture. And in their era and in their culture, that was a very rational viewpoint. And that shows how far we've come as a country, that I could go to West Point, that I can have a job now, even though I'm part Asian and I'm part black. So, and I was always really terrified of people finding out I was part black. Because the first time I ever told anybody I was part black, I remember I was 22 years old.
Wow.
I was terrified how people would react. So.
Yeah, and so much has changed even from when you were 22, right?
Right.
I mean, that was what? And that was 2002, right?
Right, exactly.
And so 8 years. Of course, so much has changed. If we think back on 9/11, which was 9 years ago, so
right.
Much has changed since then. Now, on page 84, you say that only patriotism can save America from itself. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, basically, I think the meaning of the word patriotism has been distorted. I think that a pretty widely understood meaning of the word was love of country. If you love your child and you find out your child is beating people up and stealing and lying, any loving parent would correct their child. But if you're completely apathetic to your child's well-being, you're just going to let your child do whatever and get away with murder. And I think if you love your country, then you try to make your country better, and you try to improve your country. And Martin Luther King Jr., he said that he's not speaking out against Vietnam because he hates America. He's speaking out in Vietnam because he loves America. He's worried that the Vietnam War will destroy America, and it's hurting innocent people around the world.
Right.
And I think that there's this perception that patriotism means blind obedience, and love of country, love of your child, does not mean blind obedience. Any parent knows that. You don't let your child eat candy whenever they want. You don't let your child beat people up and lie and hurt people unless you don't care about your child. And I think there's another misconception that if you're trying to improve your country, that you must hate your country. And I think that that's another misconception. If you love something, you want to make it better, you want to improve it, and you're willing to dedicate the time and action to see it grow and progress. And I think that attitude, recapturing the meaning of patriotism, showing people that critically thinking about what your country's doing and being an active citizen and practicing democracy to make your country better and questioning your government is the highest form of patriotism. The biggest danger to America is America. The biggest danger to our country is our own country. We are going to collapse from within, and only American citizens can help prevent that.
Right. I think a lot of people would agree with you, and a lot of them probably feel that we already are collapsing from within.
I think that now are very turbulent times, and it's turbulent for many reasons, but I think that the country is very fractured and there's a lot of problems that need to be resolved. And we're going down a road that's going to lead to a very bad future for our nation if we don't turn things around. But I have no doubt that we can, because I think that we're living during one of the most hopeful times in human history.
Right. Maybe, in fact, we even needed to go down this road to show the country and the world, when left unchecked, how horrible a country can become and act.
I don't know if we have to go down this road. I think that there are examples where people can affect change without having to be pushed into desperation and suffering. But I do think that the myths and illusions that we live under, going down a road where those myths and illusions collapse, is inevitable. Lies only last for so long, and every lie has a fatal flaw. It's not true. When you live under illusions and myths about certain things, eventually they begin to unravel. And I think that a lot of the myths that we've been living under are beginning to unravel now. And the question is, what direction are we going to go from here?
And that leads us, of course, to the myth makers. A big part of the book was the media. Page 6, they control and manipulate information. Page 7, 1% of the population controls most of the wealth, and on and on. You say that the media being in corporate hands is problematic. What can we do?
If you look at, for example, civil rights movement, if you look at the people who opposed racial harmony, the people who opposed ending segregation, the people who opposed ending segregation, they controlled the government, the society, the institutions, the universities, the military, most of the money. What did Martin Luther King Jr. have on his side? Only thing he had on his side was the truth. And people say there's no such thing as truth, but it's true that African Americans are human beings. It's not true that they're subhuman. And when Susan B. Anthony said that women should have the right to vote, that was a huge power struggle. And the people who opposed women's equality, they controlled the government, the society, the institutions, the universities, the military, most of the money. What did she have? She had the truth. That was all she had. And people say there's no such thing as truth. But it's true that women are human beings. It's true that women are intellectually equal to men. And today we're in a similar situation where the people who perpetuate the war system, they control the government, the society, the money, most of the money, the institutions, the universities, the military. But I think we have the truth on their side. And I think that's a powerful ally. And the question is, how do we spread that truth in a way that really gives people hope and gives people meaning and gets them ready to take action?
Right. You would think that after all these wars and all the misery that the wars have brought, that people would be at the point where they're sick and tired of it. I don't know why they don't stand up and say enough's enough. I mean, I have three boys and I can't comprehend something like that happening to them. I mean, you raise your children and you nurture them, you watch every little action that they don't fall this way or that way. And then it seems like many people are just, even if it's not their kids, many people are just willing to say, well, you know what, we got to go to war. Yeah, but what about all those years you spent with your child? Why do you have to go to war? It's like they can't even think beyond what ABC, CBS, and NBC are telling them.
Right. Well, it's like, what if I told you, I mean, let's say, for example, let's say that I had an infection in my arm and you told me, well, I got to cut your arm off. I'm sorry, but if I don't cut your arm off, you're going to die. What am I going to do? I'm going to let you cut my arm off. I don't want my arm cut off. I think it sucks to get my arm cut off, but I don't want to die, so you have to cut my arm off. And the same thing was true with war. War happens. Well, it's lamentable, but if we don't go to war, then the consequences will be much worse. If we don't go to war in Vietnam, then you'll have the domino effect, and the communists will take over America. If we don't go to war in Afghanistan, the smoking gun will be a mushroom cloud. Same thing with Iraq. The Taliban will take over the United States, and you get people to go to war by telling them that the consequences, if they don't, will be far worse. But we have to show people that's not true, and that actually going to war makes us less safe and makes us less secure. And I think that that says something positive about human beings, that people won't put up with it if there's a better option. If you tell me there's penicillin, well, we don't have to amputate your arm, we got something called penicillin, then I would choose the less destructive option. Same thing with Afghanistan or any war. If we give people a less destructive option, and we explain to them that not only is that option less destructive, but that option will actually make our country safe and make the world safer, I think most people will subscribe to that.
Right. Because as you say on page 140, from World War II until today, the majority of people killed in wars are civilians.
Right, exactly. It's something a lot of Americans don't realize, because there's this propaganda about the smart bombs and about how precise the bombs are now, precision weapons. But most of the people killed in war from World War II until today have been civilians. I was watching 60 Minutes, and a Marine colonel in Afghanistan said, if you kill 1,000 Taliban and 2 civilians, it's a loss. And this is coming from a Marine colonel in Afghanistan. In other words, if less than 1% of the casualties you inflict are civilians, you will lose. And what would happen if a foreign army came to America and killed 2 American civilians? We would go berserk. And if you're using a method of conflict resolution where you're killing the majority of the people or civilians, it's just not going to solve the problem. It'll actually make the problem worse. And you can hear that viewpoint from the military. If you look at General Petraeus and General McChrystal, their strategy of minimizing civilian casualties, it's because the military has realized that when you kill civilians, you cannot achieve any kind of security in that area or for the country.
Right. They're not killing the civilians on purpose, right?
Right. They're not killing the civilians on purpose.
They're just stupid.
Well, it's not that they're necessarily stupid. A point I like to make is I like to say, look, it's just the nature of war. You could be the smartest human being alive, but the nature of war is you're going to end up killing lots of civilians. The Army Rangers are probably the best trained soldiers in the world, if not the best trained among the best trained soldiers in the world. And the Army Rangers, they killed Pat Tillman. They killed their own comrade. I mean, they loved Pat Tillman. And they killed their own comrade, not because they wanted to kill him, but because in combat, the human brain doesn't function properly. All sorts of weird things happen to the human brain. You get tunnel vision, parts of your reasoning center shut down, and the best trained soldiers in the world killed their own comrade, Pat Tillman. That's just the nature of war. It's confusing. You have the fog of war. You have the noise and the chaos and the confusion. That's just the nature of war. You're going to end up killing not just your own comrades, but innocent people.
Right.
And that's just the nature of the beast.
This book, The End of War, How Waging Peace Can Save Humanity, Our Planet, and Our Future, was preceded by another book. So you wrote another book while you were in the Army, right?
Right. Will War Ever End?
And how did that go over with your buddies there and people who knew you?
I remember thinking, I didn't know how people would react to it, but I remember thinking if I wrote this book in the right way, people in the Army will get it. And all my friends in the Army, my West Point classmates that I know, supported me. And I even got emails from people I haven't heard from in years who told me they like what I'm doing. It doesn't mean everybody likes it, but I think that there are multiple ideologies in the Army. The Army is not just one ideology. It has many different viewpoints. And I think that what I'm writing about reflects a larger viewpoint within the military. And I think it also is very hopeful that I can talk about these issues and I can talk about peace. And it resonates with a lot of people in the Army. A lot of people join the Army thinking they're going to fight for peace. They think that they're going to make the world safer. They're going to stop terrorism. They're going to bring democracy and freedom to other countries. They're going to protect their own country and their families. And a lot of people join the Army with good intentions. And I think that the fact that I wrote the book in that way and people were able to get it is very hopeful. This attitude is not just limited to one ideology, but it's also present within the military to some extent.
On page 142, you say, "Thus far, Will War Ever End?" And that's your other book. And The End of War comprised less than 20% of the new ideas and groundbreaking content that we will unearth together in our effort to end war. So you're coming out with another couple of books, I guess, right?
Right. I'm saving most of the good stuff for the one I'm working on now. I've been working on it for a long time, about 10 years. The title is Peaceful Revolution, and the subtitle is How We Can Create the Future Necessary for Humanity's Survival. These issues are complex, and I try to present it in a manner where I gradually build upon the concepts in a way that's very accessible for people and empowering for people. And that book is just another stage in that process.
You are also not just an author, but you are the Peace Leadership Director for the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation.
Right.
Tell our listeners, what is the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation?
The Nuclear Age Peace Foundation is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization committed to creating a more peaceful and humane world through education and advocacy. And their three primary missions are abolishing nuclear weapons, strengthening international law, and empowering a new generation of peace leaders. And they do a lot of good work in terms of really trying to get these problems solved and changing human attitudes towards not just the problems, but also the solutions.
And what does the Peace Leadership Director do? What are your duties there?
In the Army, I realize how incredible the training is in the military. And right now, the training that people get in waging war is much better than the training that people get in waging peace. And we really have to bridge that gap. Most people have no training in how to solve problems peacefully or how to wage peace or how to be active or how to practice democracy. We're just not taught those skills. And that is as difficult, if not more difficult, challenge than waging war. And just like the military has high-caliber training for waging war, we need high-caliber training for waging peace to really get people empowered and active. If you take the average 22-year-old Army officer and how much they know about waging war, and an average 22-year-old activist and how much they know about waging peace, there's no comparison in terms of their level of understanding, and we really have to bridge that gap. And I give these peace leadership workshops. We're trying to develop a peace leadership academy, so it would be kind of a West Point for waging peace. And I give talks about these issues. I gave over 100 talks in the past year, and I give these peace leadership workshops. I give young people not just training in waging peace, but also leadership training to really help them succeed in a cause or in their career.
So you travel all across the country then, right?
Right. I travel quite a bit.
Now, Paul, the whole idea here is busting these myths. You mentioned in the book on page 110 about a documentary called Buying the War. That was a Bill Moyers documentary that you highly recommended. Are there any other documentaries or films that you suggest that people watch in order to help break those myths that we're all susceptible to?
Generally, in terms of documentaries, in terms of myths about security, Countdown to Zero is about abolishing nuclear weapons. And abolishing nuclear weapons is something that President Reagan, President Carter, Henry Kissinger all agree upon. It's a pretty nonpartisan issue when you look at the viewpoints who agree that the only way to make America safe is to get rid of all nuclear weapons because terrorists will eventually get one. And they don't care how many we have, they're going to use it. And the only way to keep it out of their hands is to get rid of all of them because they can't protect us against the people we're most worried about getting them, which are terrorists. I think in terms of the myths of war, not just documentaries, but there are some good war films. I think Born on the 4th of July was a good film. And I think that there's many other films and documentaries that really can be a great teaching tool for people.
Because that's a good place to start for folks, I think, because
right.
People like the movies and they like to be entertained.
Yeah, I mean, if you ask people to watch a movie or a documentary that's well made, who doesn't want to watch a good movie?
Right, exactly.
So it's exactly. A good way to start to get people just thinking about these issues.
I'll give you one last one.
Sure.
Guy comes up to you. He says, it's world peace thing. You ever see those bumper stickers on the cars, visualize world peace?
Right.
Okay, look. How could you visualize world peace when one family can't even get along together?
Well, I think that those are both problems we have to work on. But if you look at our own country, the states are able to get along together. I mean, there are many dysfunctional families in America, but you don't have Alabama going to war with Colorado. You don't have Arizona going to war with California. You don't have Michigan going to war with Minnesota. And we can create systems where there are dysfunctional situations within, but there are systems outside that keep things as a whole somewhat stable. I mean, for example, Germany and France and England, there's plenty of dysfunctional families in those countries, but I don't think they're going to go to war anytime soon. So I think if you look at what has been achieved and the fact that human beings are constantly learning and growing and progressing, and I think we're a very brilliant, innovative species when we want to be. I think we can not only learn from what we've done in the past, but even make things even more reliable and more secure in terms of relationships between countries and between states.
So it might just be the smallest unit, the family unit, is the most dysfunctional of all the other units.
I really believe that peace begins within. You hear many people say that, Mother Teresa, Albert Schweitzer, Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr. Peace does begin with the individual, but it doesn't end with the individual. And I think that families, they can be dysfunctional, they can function well, but it's hard to be human. Being human is not easy, and it's confusing to be human. And we're such a complex species, not just in family situations or in situations with millions of people, but as individuals, we're a very complex species. It's very confusing, very hard to be human, and we're going to have problems. We're going to have conflicts. But the question is, when we have conflicts, how do we resolve them? We're always going to have conflicts. For example, I have a conflict with a coworker. I have a conflict with a friend. Let's have a discussion. Let's talk through it. I'm not going to beat the person over the head with a hammer or an ice pick because we can teach people how to use productive methods of conflict resolution. I think that's one reason why the human capacity for language is so unparalleled compared to other animal species, because it's a way to resolve conflict peacefully. And so we can have conflict, and we will have conflict. We will have disagreements, but let's have a productive way to resolve that. And that's the whole point of democracy, where two people disagree about a viewpoint or two different interest groups disagree about a viewpoint. And rather than declaring war, they're able to use a democratic process and try to resolve it.
I want to give out a couple of websites here. The first one is the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, wagingpeace.org. www.wagingpeace.org, of course, all lowercase, no spaces. And, of course, a sister website to the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation where Paul K. Chappelle, because there is a Paul Chappelle, but he's a pastor of some kind.
Right.
And it's spelled C-H-A-P-P-E-L-L, is nuclearfiles.org. And there's a vast amount of information on both websites. Paul's website, where you can buy this terrific book, is paulkchappelle.com or willwarevereend.com. That's probably the better one. willwarevereend.com, of course, all lowercase, no spaces. All right, Captain Paul K. Chappelle, U.S. Army. Of course, you are not in the Army anymore. Author of The End of War, How Waging Peace Can Save Humanity, Our Planet, and Our Future. And I should have mentioned earlier that the foreword of the book was written by a fellow by the name of Gavin DeBecker, who
right.
is a pretty significant guy. He designed the Mosaic system, which was the threat assessment method used by the U.S. Supreme Court and a variety of other.
Yeah, he's brilliant.
Captain Paul K. Chappell served 7 years in the U.S. Army. The End of War, How Waging Peace Can Save Humanity, Our Planet, and Our Future. WillWarEverEnd.com. I want to thank you so much for your time. It was very enlightening, and I was very moved by the book and touched by parts of the book. And I think you're right. It is an idea, and it's going to start there. It's just a matter of time before it happens, just like the other things happened in such a short span of time. And I want to, again, thank you so much for taking the time to explain all this to our listeners.
Oh, thank you very much.